Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. We're asking this Court to reverse because the District Court made two principal errors. The first is the creation of a per se rule. We submit this violates Cleveland, the law of the circuit, and the rules of decision followed by the EEOC and the Merit System Protection Board. Secondly, the District Court decision violates the jurisprudence on summary judgment because the District Court adopted the government's view of the facts in this case. Cleveland and the law of the circuit say that Solomon has to give an explanation of the claimed contradiction. And that means that the court has to give Solomon an opportunity to explain the context-related legal conclusions about the question of reasonable accommodation. And she has to have an opportunity to reconcile or harmonize the alleged contradictions. The district court never did so. We submit that you can't say you're applying Cleveland and the law of the circuit and then to deny Ms. Solomon the opportunity to explain.
When you say that, could you refresh my recollection about the status of the proceedings in the district court? Was there discovery?
There was a complete discovery, Your Honor.
So she could have filed an affidavit explaining her statements.
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor.
And she did.
And she did.
And so did her doctor.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor.
So she had an opportunity to explain.
That's right. And the district court said,
I thought you said they had to provide her with an opportunity. He did provide her with an opportunity.
There was an opportunity, but the district court said, I'm going to decide as a threshold matter that because you applied for and received federal disability payments, I'm not going to consider any of that other stuff. I'm not going to consider the fact that you were...
Let me ask you this. Do I have to agree with that in order for you to win? That is, I see the statement by the district court about the threshold, but I also see two other places in the district court's opinion where he lays out her statements. And I thought you would say that, at least with respect to that, that what he doesn't lay out is her explanation for those statements. But that's different than saying he just said that acceptance of FERS is the end of the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
You see what I mean? He does say at the very end, for example, he says, Solomon's receipt of FERS disability benefits then, which she received upon representation that she was, quote, unable to work, cannot be reconciled. So he takes into consideration her statement. In the two paragraphs before, he says, the district court says, as part of the application, Solomon represented that since April 2004, I've been unable to work because my medical condition remains redacted. Dr. Kozin's letter states that it has been clear that disability retirement is the only viable option in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, but there's also a history, there's a record where that shows that Solomon was forced to apply for disability, that was the only accommodation that they granted her. And in creating the threshold analysis, the per se rule, the district court did not take that into consideration.
Well, it's not a per se rule based, at least the district court didn't apply a per se rule based only on acceptance of FERS, but on these statements about inability to work.
That's correct, Your Honor, and we think under Cleveland and the law of the circuit, what the district court should have done is considered the fact that Solomon repeatedly, almost continuously, asked for accommodations throughout the summer.
So you would say that there was a genuine issue of material fact as to whether the reason she was unable to work was that she had been denied an accommodation?
We submit that's correct, Your Honor. And if you look at Ms. Solomon's deposition, for example, she goes on at great length talking about how she was forced to apply for disability retirement, that was the only accommodation that they gave her. There are all the emails in there. She's asking for an opportunity to work at home. She's asking to work flexible hours. She's asking for advanced sick leave, and these requests are completely denied to her. Ultimately, she says, I give up. They're not going to accommodate me, and therefore I applied for federal disability. And in terms of what she actually...
In applying for that, regulations say you're eligible only if you couldn't be reasonably accommodated, right? And she's asked a question on a form.
That's correct.
Somewhat ambiguous question, but she indicates that she meets that criterion.
This is on page 1176 in the appendix. The question 7 says, what accommodations have you requested? And she lists them: a flexible work schedule, relocation of her workstation, advanced sick leave, an entry into the leave donor program.
She wasn't given the regulations that govern this, was she?
She had no idea what the regulations were, Your Honor. And you know, in terms of the question, everybody talks about, were you disabled? But nobody asked the question, well, were you disabled but could have been accommodated with reasonable accommodations? We submit that the accommodations that she was asking for were reasonable, and the agency just rejected them out of hand with statements like...
One question was what she'd asked for. Wasn't there another question that's considerably more ambiguous?
Absolutely, Your Honor, and that's next year. Question 7B says, has your agency been able to grant your request? And this, you know, they
get... Way to phrase the question.
Your Honor, she believed that various times that, well...
I mean, literally, she would say, yes, they were able, but they refused.
That's right.
Instead, she says no, because she takes it to mean, did they accommodate?
That's right, Your Honor. So she didn't have the opportunity to say, yes, but they refused. She said no because they told her that they couldn't accommodate.
And if she had said yes, but they refused, she would have been denied the first disability, or, I mean, the retirement, right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So she's kind of pushed into saying what? And answering the question as though she had been, there was no way to accommodate her disability.
That's correct, Your Honor. So it's perhaps stacked to that effect, but this
Should
brings
we relieve
us
her of understanding what the regulations require?
No one ever mentioned that. For example, the letter from Dr. Cousins says this is the last option, and he's making that statement within the broader factual background of Ms. Solomon requesting these
accommodations. Well, there's nothing in the letter that says that, right? The letter just says defers. I think it's defers, isn't it?
It was submitted as part of the application.
Saying she has no viable option, no other viable option at this point.
That's
and he's a doctor, so presumably this is about her medical condition and her ability.
That's correct, Your
Not
Honor.
Not about her legal limitations.
Yes, Your Honor. And
well, before you say yes, Your Honor, to that, I thought that the doctor's position later was that this was based on his understanding of what the agency was willing to do for her.
Absolutely,
yes,
Your Honor.
That's in the affidavit.
In his affidavit, he sets forth why it is that...
The question, though, is whether we can get to the affidavit or whether the structure of the system is preclusive.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Yeah.
It's our view that under the law of the circuit and under Cleveland that the court has to consider the entire context of why it was that Solomon actually had to apply for disability retirement.
Now, it seemed to me, if this is correct, that this is rather compelling, that I think you said she's got a year from the termination of her job to apply for the FERS disability. Is that right? There's a one-year limitation?
I don't know. She was never terminated, Your Honor. She went right from leave without pay to...
wasn't she subject to a one-year limitation on applying? I thought you made that point. Maybe it's in the amicus brief.
Well, that's often how the process works. But she went from basically leave without pay status to the receiving the Social Security disability and the disability from FERS.
Well, it's the FERS one that's at issue here.
That's correct.
Okay. If there's a one-year limitation on that, as I believe we were informed, am I correct about that? My law clerk will tell me in a minute. Then it would mean that if the government is right here, that because of the structure of the criteria for his disability, that it's inconsistent with an ADA claim, then it would imply that any dispute with the agency would have to be resolved within a year, or she would be out of time for her FERS application.
I didn't understand that to be the case in terms of how the application worked, and since she went right from employed status to retired status under FERS, that issue didn't come up below.
I know it doesn't in this case. I'm told it's a 22 of the amicus brief. Well, the government can think about that between now and time we hear from the government.
This court in Swanks talked about the creating an untenable choice between rights that an employee has either under the ADA or under the Rehabilitation Act or the D.C. Human Rights Act, but the key expression is untenable choice, and that was where what Solomon was placed in. And we submit that nothing in either statute requires a disabled individual like Solomon to make a choice between which statutory rights she wants to pursue and to decide which rights she's going to have to abandon. Solomon was never warned. She was never told that she couldn't do both. And it's contrary to public policy to say to the agencies, well, we're going to build in this incentive. It's contrary to the pro-work, pro-employment, anti-discrimination policy in the ADA and the Rehabilitation Act. And affirming the district court would shield agencies from liability for discrimination on the basis of handicap and would make the decisions to force a federal employee to take retirement. It would make those decisions to be unreviewable. And affirming would encourage agencies to deny accommodation in favor of pushing the employees into disability retirement. There's no reason to deny Solomon her day in court where the agency unreasonably refused to consider her request for reasonable accommodation.
Can I just ask one question on the age discrimination? Sorry, I got the word wrong. What's the evidence of age discrimination?
I reread the briefs in preparation for today, and as I certainly intended to write the appellant's brief, we focused on the retaliation because Solomon engaged in a sweep of protected activity beginning in December of 2003, and she filed a EEO complaint. And
That's retaliation for her exercise of Rehabilitation Act, right?
Well, it's retaliation for everything because this December 2003 informal complaint raised age, it raised race, and it raised...
You're not making a substantive age discrimination claim, only a retaliation claim?
We did below, Your Honor, but I did not intend certainly to raise it on appeal in my briefs, and I was therefore surprised to see that the government was suggesting that was an issue.
Well, they'll be happy to know that you're not raising it. That eliminates that one. Okay, thank you.
What happened, in terms of the overall consideration of the summary judgment jurisprudence, there's no question that Ms. Solomon had significant depression issues, but we'd submit that the key issue for decision by this court as to whether she could have continued to work with reasonable accommodations. She repeatedly requested those accommodations. She was ultimately certainly viewing the evidence from a perspective most favorable to Solomon that she was forced to retire and that the district court should have considered all that in making the determination as to whether or not Ms. Solomon was somehow stopped under whatever theory of law, whether she was stopped from actually going ahead and receiving the pursuing her rights under the Rehabilitation Act. And the sort of things that she requested are certainly the sort of things that accommodations that are normally granted. The government at one point seemed to suggest that there might have been a problem here. It might have been difficult for us to do this. Well, they never raised the undue burden issue as a defense in their answer, and they never clearly raised that as a significant issue below. And part of the reason for that is they're perhaps in an awkward position about raising that defense. Why? Because they never talked to her. She sent an email saying, I want to work part-time. I want to transition back in the workforce. And they, the emails would come back saying things like, I do not agree to allow that employee to work at home, or I do not agree to let her work part-time. And they kept insisting on additional information from her doctor, even though the agency had sufficient information, certainly from Dr. Cousins in early June, that from his calculation by mid-July, Ms. Solomon should have been ready to go back to work part-time. And if you consider not only Solomon's deposition, where she makes it clear that she was seeking these accommodations, there's a long email record, there's her subsequent declaration that these are all consistent, that, and as Dr. Cousins suggested, with the reasonable accommodations, Ms. Solomon could have transitioned. She could have been prepared to go back to work, ideally by mid-July of 2004. The agency did no analysis. They presented no proof that they could not accommodate Ms. Solomon. They just brushed her off. They said, we're not going to, we're just not going to accommodate you for whatever reason. And finally, on the question of the, you know, what it is that they had to do, you know, they seemed to have absolutely no interest at all in meeting their statutory obligations toward Ms. Solomon.
Thank you, Mr. Farrell.
I see my time has expired.
Yes, we'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The district court in this case did not resolve the case on a motion to dismiss or a pre-discovery summary judgment motion. After a lengthy discovery period, which appellant's counsel now admits involved complete discovery, the district court decided the government's motion for summary judgment on a full record before it. Ms. Solomon below had a full and fair opportunity to explain the patent discrepancy between her statements in her application for FERS disability benefits, which includes expressly saying, and this is on the joint appendix at page 1177, since April 2004, I have been unable to work because my medical condition remains in crisis after being hospitalized and continued treatment.
Of course, that was at a time when she couldn't get any accommodation from her employer.
Your Honor, it was a time when Ms. Solomon's medical condition prevented her from working any regular schedule. The Department of Agriculture gave her virtually unlimited leave to recuperate. Unfortunately, she did not. And I think the record is very clear, based in part not only on Ms. Solomon and her physician's statements that she was completely unable to work from at least April of 2004 until she applied for disability retirement, but also her conduct. Her conduct in this case was not simply applying for FERS benefits and having that application approved. Her conduct is included in this case receiving FERS benefits, which are only available for individuals who cannot work even with a reasonable accommodation during the last 5 years.
Well, she didn't know that. How do you know she knew that?
Your Honor, below, Ms. Solomon never made the argument, and in her briefs to this court, she never made the argument that she did not know.
The burden is on you if you're bringing a summary judgment motion to, and this argument is based on the suggestion that she knew what the OPM regulations provided. Is there anything in the acceptance of the FERS disability where you have to swear or attest that you've read the regulations as to what you're entitled to or not?
I don't believe so, but in this case, even after we moved for summary judgment today, she's still taking FERS benefit.
But in fact, the only thing that the application warns her of is that any false statements will be considered criminal. There's nothing on the form that says that you can't apply for disability benefits if you can work with a reasonable accommodation.
Your Honor, the form does expressly ask whether or not the agency has been able to accommodate her.
Correct, but it doesn't ask her whether she's unable to work even with an accommodation, right? That would.
But she said that.
In fact, why doesn't the form ask that? Wouldn't that solve all these problems?
I don't disagree that OPM perhaps could and make you the form more explicit, but her statements are not qualified.
You've invoked, well.
There's no qualification in her statement that she's been unable to work because her medical condition remains in crisis.
You've invoked the principles of judicial estoppel here, and you believe this, we can affirm on those grounds, right? And
yes.
You understand, I mean, you agree, don't you, that for judicial estoppel to work, the conflicting statements have to be clearly inconsistent. Clearly. Right?
Yes, and I think they are here. And Multiple statements are inconsistent.
Tell me, all right, so what in these two questions give you a clear... The first question is, what accommodation have you requested? And she just states as a factual matter what she requested.
But, Your Honor, that's
so
not...
So where does that say that... is a clearly inconsistent statement with getting disability benefits?
I think looking at the application in toto, well as her subsequent statements and her contemporaneous medical documentation, reflects that there's a clear inconsistency. She not only said that the agency was unable to accommodate her, but she said, again, that's on page 1177, that she was unable to work.
Well, suppose her allegation is that the agency refused to accommodate her and, in fact, forced her into disability as a...
Then that's something she should have brought to the attention of OPM, Your
Honor. She alleges it in her complaint. She states it again and again in her depositions.
In her complaint, she expressly says that on June 2nd, 2004, Solomon's doctor advised the department that Solomon was completely unable to work. The complaint that's on page, joint appendix on page
three. Paragraph 17 of the complaint.
It's paragraph 10, Your Honor.
I'm looking at paragraph 17.
Oh, I'm sorry.
As a result of defendant's actions, including its refusal to allow her reasonable accommodation and the refusal to allow her to participate in the advanced sick leave program, she was forced to apply for disability.
Your Honor.
And if you're right, then agencies could, instead of awarding a reasonable accommodation, could force their employees into disability.
That's not right, Your Honor, because Ms. Solomon could have done a number of things in order to preserve her argument that she believed the Department of Agriculture was failing to reasonably accommodate her. She could have told OPM that she believed she could be reasonably accommodated, but if she is wrong, then she is eligible for FERS benefits. She could have asked...
Where on the form would you put that?
Well, Your Honor, she submitted a separate statement as well as a doctor's statement, so we think it would be incumbent upon her to at least raise the issue with OPM. Moreover, she could have asked OPM to stay her FERS application pending resolution of her Rehabilitation Act claim. She had a wide range of things she could have done to preserve both claims. She did not.
You want her to have no money during the entire period in which the court resolves the ADA claim?
Your Honor,
Rehabilitation,
she could have.
That sounds like forcing her.
No, Your Honor, she, as we made clear in our brief, and as well as the Supreme Court made clear in Cleveland, she could receive virtually any benefits, including SSDI benefits, which she applied for and successfully obtained during the pendency of
but she couldn't receive her FERS benefits. You don't think that would have any incentive effect on her to not be able to receive
it? I don't think it changes her obligation to tell the truth to OPM. And well, it doesn't change her obligation to reconcile her inconsistency.
Which question on the form did she not answer truthfully?
I think she did answer the questions truthfully on the form.
If her position is that she could have, with an accommodation, done it, but the problem was that the agency had already told her that it wasn't going to give her an accommodation, what question on the form did she answer falsely?
Your Honor, I think it would be question five, and that's, describe how your disease injury interferes with performance of your duties, your attendance, and your conduct. I think that's where, when she expressly says that since April 2004 she's been unable to work because of her mental impairment.
That's inconsistent with the fact that she's been unable to work because the agency hasn't given her the accommodation she requested.
I think her unqualified statement that since April of 2004 she has been unable to work because of her mental condition remaining in crisis is inconsistent with her claim now, particularly
you
when
you probably never tried to prosecute a perjury case because I wouldn't think you'd have a chance of getting even one juror on that question.
Well, Your Honor, again, under even the Supreme Court's decision in Cleveland says we have to look at the statements in context.
Right.
And in context of applying for FERS benefits, and certainly now for 5 years receiving them, I think we have to under Cleveland, recognize that she was saying that she could not work even with an accommodation. Nowhere in her statement does she say that the agency...
You quoted from paragraph 5 of her statement of disability. Since April 04, I've been unable to work because of my medical condition, right? So the nearest context to that might be paragraph 6, in which she says she's been on leave without pay since January 04, not April. And that process... and being on leave without pay has further aggravated my condition with fear of losing everything I've worked for. So she's saying as of January, when she went on leave without pay, she wasn't as bad off as she is now or since perhaps April 04. Right? So if she was denied a reasonable accommodation in January and put on leave without pay instead, and it's only in April 04 that she says since then she's been unable to work. Because her position is she could have worked in January and February and March, but they wouldn't accommodate her. Where is the inconsistency?
Your Honor, she did not request any accommodations until late March. On April, I think it's March 20th.
Still before she used, before she's saying she becomes unable to work in April, but she's put on leave without pay earlier. She requests accommodation earlier.
Your Honor, she first requested accommodation, I believe it was March 29th.
When did her first supervisor allow her to put up the privacy screen and work at home? Wasn't that before then?
Your Honor, I don't believe there was any allowance for her to work at home before then.
I mean, work beyond the normal work hours.
I believe she had a set schedule that did not change during that period. I think that she was staying late to catch up on some work that
she was
doing.
Right, and she had the privacy screen, right, which her supervisor then, and that was all prior to that time, correct?
Yes, and in April.
And her allegation is that that was an informal accommodation that the agency then revoked.
Your Honor, we believe that the agency, within a week of learning that she was requesting accommodation, asked her to provide supporting medical
documentation. No, you're missing my point. You're missing my point. Earlier, her first supervisor did provide two accommodations, correct?
No, Your Honor.
No?
Informal accommodations.
Your Honor, I don't believe...
Isn't that the term that was used?
Yeah.
Informal accommodations?
That's her term to explain the fact that she herself
This is summary judgment, and her allegation is that that was the agency's informal accommodation to her disability that the agency later revoked.
And the agency had, I think, under the regulations in place, as well as this court's decision in Stewart, the opportunity to ask for supporting medical documentation. Dr. Cousins asked the agency to provide her with a screen.
I'm not questioning that. I'm just questioning your point that she didn't ask for accommodation until the formal letter. That was all.
And what my response, I suppose, directly to that is, Your Honor, there was no indication in the record that when she erected this screen, that was an attempted informal or otherwise accommodation for her.
Really? She said that's what she needed it for, and the supervisor agreed to it on those terms. Why else would it have been put there? Why else would it have been put there? Was she engaged in gambling that she didn't want someone to see? I mean, she put up the privacy screen because it was necessary, she said, to accommodate her disability.
No, Your Honor, she put up the privacy screen, she said, so that it would essentially help drown out some noise.
Related to her disability.
I don't think at the time she put up the privacy screen that there was any evidence before either Sylvia Booth, her first-line supervisor, or Deborah Lawrence at that time, her second-level supervisor,
You don't think a jury looking at this record could conclude based on that? We would have to reverse any jury verdict which concluded that the agency had revoked its informal accommodation?
Based on the record before this court, yes, there is not sufficient evidence for her to survive summary judgment.
Can I ask you about the appendix, page 1538, which is her declaration?
Page again?
1538. It says... despite my many difficulties, starting with paragraph 9, despite my many difficult circumstances and challenges in my life, with the knowledge and approval of my supervisor, as Sylvia Booth, I still managed to get my work done by starting earlier or by staying later at the office. Paragraph 11, I purchased the cubicle privacy screen. Prior to purchasing it, I showed it to and discussed it with my supervisor, Sylvia Booth. We discussed the considerable amount of stress I was under. In fact, Booth indicated that the screen was a good idea. Booth agreed that the cubicle privacy screen would help block the distractions. Doesn't that sound like, whether or not it's true, I mean, I appreciate that's something you might dispute at trial, but that sounds like this was put in for the purpose of accommodating her stress concerns.
Your Honor, I believe here, if you look at the email exchange she had in late March, or I guess in beginning in March with Ms. Booth, she explains to Ms. Booth why she essentially had erratic leave during that time period and why she was needing to sort of stay late to catch up on work she wasn't able to complete during her normal work hours. And that's when Ms. Booth indicated to her that the agency not only wanted to do everything they could do to accommodate her, but that they would need medical documentation if she believed she needed an accommodation. So I believe that if I go to my supervisor and say, sorry, I came in late today, I've been under a lot of stress, is it okay if I stay a little bit late to catch up on some work? And the supervisor says yes, I don't believe that would qualify me later on saying that, aha, I had asked for an accommodation and my supervisor let me do it on a few times. In this case, we're dealing with certainly by March when she first raises the issue with Ms. Booth, a situation where this was not going to be a simple instance of one or two times letting an employee stay late. She needed a significant alteration to her schedule in order to perform her duties. And as we believe the record demonstrates, she needed a schedule that would enable her essentially to come and go as her medical condition allowed. And we think under this court's decision in Carr, the Rehabilitation Act does not require that. The last thing I'll say, Your Honor.
Well, before you say your last thing, let me ask you a more general question. Your argument is that we should, that what the district court was doing here was applying principles of judicial estoppel, right?
Yes, as well as, yes.
You know, if I just read that opinion, that would not have occurred to me. You know, he doesn't say any, he doesn't use the phrase judicial estoppel. The district court doesn't apply any of the three factors. And he says again and again that this is a threshold issue and that she's precluded from seeking this relief.
I think, Your Honor, that the district court repeatedly recited the Supreme Court's decision in Cleveland, which was applying the judicial estoppel doctrine sort of specifically in the context of an employee who has sought disability benefits and claimed in seeking those benefits that they
cannot. But then why did the district court say several times that, including right at the beginning, that this case can be resolved on the basis of the threshold issue?
Because
her application for disability benefits precludes a rehab case.
Your Honor, it's not just her application.
I'm just saying what the district court said. The district court seems to have treated it as an automatic bar.
Based on the complete record before it, it is a bar in this case, and it still is a threshold issue. That is to say, it is, I think, distinct from the district court continuing with its analysis on the merits of her claim, which we believe there, again, was ample and is ample evidence in the record to affirm the district court even on the merits. If you even allow Ms. Solomon to contradict her prior testimony and the testimony of her treating physician.
A recipient, I'm reading from the first sentence of the district court's decision, or second, a recipient of disability benefits, quote, is precluded from seeking relief under the Rehab Act. Is precluded. There's no.
And he says that. The court goes on, Your Honor, to examine the record in this case on its entirety in determining that Ms. Solomon, not every person who applies for first.
Well, why did he say this? Why did he say several times that? If that's not what he meant.
It seems to me he says flat out that FERS is different than SSDI.
Yeah.
It is, and it certainly affected his analysis. But he
nothing to do with her particular application. Right.
Well, I think, Your Honor, again, the district court, leaving aside sort of his topic sentences or perhaps some language that was a bit broader than it I think was intended. If you look at what he did, how he reached his conclusion, again, this was not decided on a motion to dismiss or a pre-discovery summary judgment motion where the district court said, oh, she received FERS benefits, therefore that's it, that's the end of the analysis.
What is the government's position? Is the receipt of FERS benefits alone with the checkoff as she did on the form, is that alone enough to preclude a Rehabilitation Act suit?
I think the answer is that the district court should, in this case, did look at the full record before it.
So the government agrees that it is not that merely accepting FERS benefits and merely saying that the government's been unable to accommodate or whatever that part of the form, checking that form, that would not be enough to preclude a Rehabilitation Act lawsuit.
I think that it could be enough. But I don't.
That's all there was. I'm just asking if that is all there is in the record.
I think you would have to see whether the plaintiff is in any way, shape, or form attempting to explain how their receipt of FERS benefits, particularly in a case like this where they've done it over a course of a long period of time, is consistent with their now claim that they could have worked with an accommodation.
So The government's position is that once you file a lawsuit and the government tells you that that receipt is inconsistent, then to continue is inconsistent? Is that?
No, Your Honor. I think the inconsistency is the point at which she makes the statements under oath, several statements under oath, including with the assistance of her physician.
That's why I'm trying to figure out on this. You know, we've been going back, or the other members of the panel have been going back and forth with you on the threshold issue. I just want to know whether the second argument is a backup argument, or this is a backup argument, or the government's position is. I mean, the government can have any position it wants. It's the government's position that if you sign, you're out, and you can't have as an explanation that the government wasn't able to, you know, didn't give me accommodations. The only explanation, there is no explanation, really.
Your Honor, I think my bit of hesitation is that, as I think this court's jurisprudence on Rehabilitation Act and ADA claims demonstrates, there is virtually an unlimited number of disabilities that individuals can have. There are virtually, I think, an unlimited number of types of accommodations that individuals can ask. And so I think what the district court did in this case was entirely correct in not just assigning labels or taking a categorical approach. I think the district court looked at Ms. Solomon's specific statements, her specific condition, and her psychiatrist's specific statements and what the medical records demonstrate. And based on this case, Ms. Solomon's condition, the district court correctly concluded that her receipt in 2004 and continued receipt of FERS benefits precludes her from now taking a clearly inconsistent position that she could have worked, and in fact, I think is arguing that today she still could work if given a reasonable accommodation. And in fact, she hasn't worked, not just for the USDA, but anywhere in the last 5 years. Her position, certainly before OPM, has been consistent throughout. She's entitled to FERS benefits. She cannot work because of her mental disability. And it's those clearly inconsistent.
And what do you think, what is the government's position about what she should have said to OPM in view of her allegation that...
Your Honor,
let me finish my question.
I'm sorry.
In view of her allegation that she was forced into seeking disability payments because the agency denied her reasonable accommodation.
Your Honor,
what should she have said?
I think there are a number of different things she could have said or done, including she could have told OPM that there was a dispute between her and her employer. She believed she can still work.
But then she couldn't have gotten disability benefits.
Well, then it would have been
Disqualified from disability benefits.
Not necessarily. It would have been up to OPM then to make the initial determination the determination for itself that whether she could or could not be reasonably accommodated.
That's Has OPM ever done that? You mean OPM might say to her, yes, I know your agency has denied you reasonable accommodation, but we think the agency is wrong and that it should have, in which case she wouldn't be qualified for disability benefits, right?
Yes, but then she would have a stronger Rehabilitation Act claim, Your Honor.
But your point is, as I understand it, your point then is anybody in her position who feels she's either been forced to seek disability benefits or who was misled by the agency. I mean, maybe the agency said, look, you know, why don't you go get disability benefits while we try to work this out? There's no way a person in that position could, under your theory, get disability benefits, right?
No.
Their only remedy is the rehab case.
No, that's not right. Because if she goes to OPM and says, this is just one example, one instance of an approach she could have taken, I believe there are many more, but if she goes to OPM and says to OPM, you know, this is what my condition, these are my limitations, I believe I can be reasonably accommodated, but my agency is unreasonably denying me these accommodations, and OPM decides or determines that Ms. Solomon was wrong, that she could, you know, her limitations could not be reasonably accommodated, then they could approve, and I think they would, under their regulations, be obligated disability application.
But that's not a very... That's not a very intelligent way for her about getting disability benefits. She has to assume that the agency will disagree with her. I don't understand that.
Which agency, Your Honor, OPM or?
OPM.
I don't believe that's a fair assumption. And
moreover,
I think either way,
I was just responding to your hypothetical.
On her form.
I was just responding to your hypothetical.
Did you ever answer Judge Tatel's question whether OPM has ever done this?
Right. Your Honor, I don't know.
Does OPM have authority to say... It almost sounds like you're suggesting that you can appeal to OPM the refusal to reasonably accommodate. If OPM decided that, in fact, a reasonable accommodation would take care of you, but your agency hasn't provided it, does OPM have some kind of authority? I mean, is there some regulation or something that gives them authority to order the agency to provide an accommodation?
I don't know, but I think that it is fair to assume that the Department of Agriculture then would have taken OPM's determination seriously.
We get plenty of cases coming from agencies that have denied accommodation, and no agency in your office has never come in here and said, they failed to exhaust, they should have asked OPM.
Right.
Well, Your Honor, I think, again, that was just one example of what she could have done. She could have asked OPM to stay her FERS benefits claim pending the resolution of her Rehabilitation Act claim.
She felt she was desperate. She couldn't work. She had no money.
Well, Your Honor, desperation and financial desperation, which, again, she could have gotten.
I don't think you want to finish your sentence.
Well, Your Honor, I think ultimately.
Let me ask you this.
Okay.
Go ahead. You think ultimately what?
Ultimately, I think you have two irreconcilable positions that she's taking in terms of getting FERS benefits and pursuing a Rehabilitation Act.
They're not irreconcilable if either A, she was acting under a limited amount of information and didn't know they were irreconcilable, or B, that as she alleges in paragraph 17 of the complaint, she was forced into this by the agency. Then they're not irreconcilable.
Well, she never made the point A. She never argued that below, and even in her brief, she didn't argue that. And in terms of point B, I don't think that actually changes the analysis, because if the statements, really the unequivocal statements she's made to OPM and the contemporaneous documentation reflect her saying that she is completely unable to work, she has to reconcile them.
Okay, so let me ask you
another. She hasn't attempted to do that
Going over old ground, okay? Assume that we end up disagreeing with you on this and think it has to go back, and assume on remand the district court concludes that she can pursue her rehab case and she wins, okay?
That she can pursue?
Yeah, and that she succeeds on the merits in showing that she was discriminated against under the Act because the agency didn't supply the proper reasonable accommodation. She says that won't be any disadvantage to the government because whatever she's recovered in disability, whatever she's received in disability benefits would be deducted from her back pay award. Is that right? Is that what would happen? I mean, assume she gets a certain amount of back pay, X amount.
I think at that point.
And then she's had Y disability benefits. The government would deduct Y from X, right?
At that point, I think any back pay award would have to be deducted for any FERS benefit she accepted.
Okay.
But I think also that would be converting FERS into essentially an insurance policy during the pendency of any rehabilitation.
Well, there's another way to look at it, too, it might be a way to ensure that these two statutes work well together. That is, that if an agency is resisting reasonable accommodations under situations where someone needs disability, they get the disability, and at the time they win their rehab case, that's deducted from their award.
But that's not
so they work nicely together.
In fact,
in Cleveland and in Swanks, we said, look, the whole purpose of this statute is to keep people working, not on disability. So they work together to do that, don't they?
SSDI and an ADA claim can exist comfortably side by side. We don't think.
Yeah, but we're not talking about SSI here.
Under SSDI, in Cleveland, the Supreme Court said the plaintiff can't simply ignore their contrary statements.
Uh-huh.
So to me, at least, if this court is inclined to.
So in this case, one of the forces that was at work in those cases, namely the government interest in keeping people working rather than on disability, doesn't apply here?
That's not what I'm saying, Your
Honor. Oh, what were you saying then?
What I'm saying is that the Supreme Court in Cleveland set up a framework in determining whether a plaintiff who says in the context of SSDI, a statute in which an employee can still be working and be eligible for, that the plaintiff cannot simply disagree with or retract their statements they made in order to receive those benefits.
Right.
So even if that standard were to apply here to a situation where Ms. Solomon not only got SSDI benefits, but she applied for and got FERS benefits and made inconsistent statements, she would still be obligated under the Supreme Court's decision in Cleveland to reconcile them. And she made no effort to do so here in the district court or on appeal.
Can I ask you a question? I'm intrigued and but confused about the relationship between the agency's determination and OPM's determination. So, say the agency goes through the whole process and makes a determination that no reasonable accommodation will resolve the problem. Your position is that she's not eligible for FERS as long as she thinks a reasonable accommodation would solve the problem?
No, Your Honor. I think she can go before OPM and say and candidly tell OPM the position she finds herself in, that she believes she can work with a reasonable accommodation, but to the extent she's wrong, then she is entitled to FERS benefits.
Is there a section that enables, this is why I asked the authority question before, I guess, is this futile? That is, can OPM require the agency to reverse itself? I hadn't thought of OPM as a sort of an appellate board of review on this question. That's why I'm confused.
Well,
what if OPM decides that she's not, that there is no reasonable accommodation, but she still thinks there is? And in fact, later she sues and we say there was one. Would she have been able to get FERS during that period?
If OPM,
if OPM says, yeah, you know, we agree with the agency, there is no reasonable accommodation, but she still thinks there is. Is she entitled to one? Is she entitled to FERS disability?
Well, in this case, she was.
I'm asking to be a little hypothetical because I'm trying to figure out what the relationship is.
I think the point at which OPM makes the determination that she is entitled to FERS benefits is the point at which she receives them. If she disagrees,
but she says and she gives up, can she bring a rehabilitation suit? She accepts the FERS, knowing in her mind and later correctly in ours that she was able to work with an accommodation.
No, because I think she's estopped. I think the point.
Without any record. So that means she can't bring a suit. If the agency decides, including OPM decides, that there's no reasonable accommodation, and she accepts FERS. At that point, she's estopped.
Just to clarify my last answer, I think at that point you would again want to look at the record about what is the accommodation she's seeking. What were her statements before OPM?
Well, what if she's been saying all along that she thinks she's entitled to an accommodation will work? OPM in the end doesn't believe her, or doesn't agree. Forget it; it's not a belief situation. Can she at that point accept? Can she then refile the form saying, well, I tried, the agency did all these things, but I know that I could do this with an accommodation, but you won't give it to me, and you've made a final decision. Can she take disability then?
Your Honor, I think at that
point. And sue?
I think at that point you would have a situation where it's less her statements and more her conduct, which is irreconcilable with her Rehabilitation Act claim.
Oh, so you are saying then. So then I'm just trying to play this out. Ultimately, the government's bottom line is that you can't, under any circumstances, no matter what you say, you really, in the end, can't accept FERS disability and sue?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying, at least in your hypothetical, which again is, I think, very different than the case we're presented with here, I think at that point, the government, at least in this case, has not said, taken a categorical position one way or another. I think at least our position is really focused on what happened in this case. I think, again, just what I said a few moments ago.
Well, I still don't understand why someone in the circumstances, just taking her allegation for a moment, I'm still confused about whether the government thinks she could ever legitimately get disability benefits, or if she could, whether that would bar a rehab case. She alleges that she was denied reasonable accommodation because the government wanted to force her to quit and take disability.
Well, Your Honor, I think
so. Now she goes and she gets her disability, or she seeks it. Is it your theory that either A, she can't get disability under those circumstances, or B, she can, but then she couldn't bring a rehab case?
I think it's closer to the latter, but I think it's that she may well to sort of. To
and how would she qualify for disability?
She may well be barred.
How would she qualify if she believes she can work? She says, all I need is that privacy screen, and they say no. And if she believes she can work with the privacy screen, how does she get disability benefits then?
Your Honor, I don't believe there's anything in the record that reflects that she could.
No. Just assume those facts are true. I'm hypothesizing the facts. Just assume they're true. Answer by saying that's not what the evidence says. Just assume it's true.
Assume that she
could work with the privacy screen, and the agency said no because they figured it would be a lot cheaper to have her out of there and taking disability than to pay for a privacy screen.
And she's not seeking any other accommodations in your hypothetical?
No, that's it.
Well, I think then it would be, again, incumbent upon her to tell OPM the position she finds herself in.
Well, but then wouldn't they have to deny disability?
Your Honor, I don't think...
If she's telling them, I can work with a reasonable accommodation, all I need is a privacy screen.
Then OPM would have to make the determination for itself whether or not the privacy screen is a reasonable accommodation. That's something that by regulation OPM is required to do.
Done.
By regulation they're required to do. And yet you said they've never done it as far as you know.
No, I'm saying I don't know whether, what I think I had said before was, what I'm saying is they're required to make the determination whether or not she can or cannot work with a reasonable accommodation. I don't know whether they have made a determination. Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't look like that. It looks like the regulations say you're not eligible if you can work with a reasonable accommodation, and we ask you whether the agency was able to provide you with a reasonable accommodation, and they get a certificate from the agency as well.
There is a supervisor statement that is generally submitted in support of a FERS application and was submitted in this case.
And was submitted here. What did it say?
It's on appendix at 11, looks like 88. She says that Ms. Solomon's, because of her use of extended absences, the work has had to be assigned to other staff members. She doesn't know when she'll be able to return to work in the foreseeable future, thus she can't plan any work around her. This is on page JA 1189. And it asks on whether or not the agency has been able to accommodate her, and the supervisor said that they granted her use of leave and approved her for use in the leave donor program. I mean, I think it's important to point out that the agency.
What's your question about whether the agency was able to accommodate her?
Well, unfortunately, my copy is not particularly clean, but this is on joint appendix on page 1189.
Yeah, which question?
It looks like it's under section E.
What efforts have been made to accommodate the employee in the current position? All right?
And it says they granted her use of leave and they approved her for the leave donor program. I mean, they granted Ms. Solomon virtually unlimited. Albeit unpaid, but unlimited leave to recuperate. And unfortunately, I think for everyone, she did not.
She didn't what?
She did not recuperate to the point where she could resume working.
Well, one of her allegations is that it was the agency's behavior that worsened her condition.
And I think if you look at the contemporaneous medical documentation, as well as her statements in her FERS application, I don't think the record supports that. I think that she, again, is contradicting prior statements she made under oath, as well as the contemporaneous medical documentation that reflected it was a number of personal hardships that exacerbated her pre-existing depression. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Robeck. Mr. Carl, you used all of your time. You used all of your time, didn't you?
Your Honor, promise me a minute.
You really want to take it?
No, I don't. Thank you.
Thank you. Case is submitted. Thank you both.